Last week, somebody was talking about the lectureship. Said, what's your topic? And I said, well, it's... And I said, you know, we turned in a manuscript several months ago, and I'm certain I wrote something. But it's been so long ago, I can't remember what my topic is. And it took me a while to remember what it was that the subject was. And so I thought, well, I'd probably better look at this thing before I try to speak on it. And so I got the book, and I opened it up, and it just happened to fall open to a page. I started reading and thought, well, this isn't very good. I wonder who the moron was that wrote this, and realized it was me. And so then I reread it and decided it was a lot better than I'd first thought once I realized that. It wasn't quite that bad, but there was a certain delay in between the writing and the delivering of it. And I was joking, of course. I did remember pretty much what I'd written, and I wouldn't make that call until I did find out who'd written it, lest I make that judgment upon myself. You know, when we begin to study our Bibles, we find that there are some individual facts, obviously, but sometimes these coalesce into grand themes. We recognize this, and when we begin to see that there are certain themes developed in the Bible, and they are developed extensively, we come to realize that these are worthy of some greater consideration. Now, obviously, every Bible topic, every thus saith the Lord, demands our obedience. That's certainly true. But when the Bible extensively develops a weighty topic, it seems that it's worthy of our intense scrutiny. In fact, in some occasions in our New Testaments, we find entire chapters of the Bible devoted to one topic. And even the most immature Bible student would recognize that faith is the subject, for instance, of Hebrews chapter 11. While 1 Corinthians chapter 13 develops the subject of love extensively. And so it is when we see such themes, they arrest our attention. And we recognize then that here is a chapter that develops a grand theme. And so it is with Matthew chapter 25, in which is the subject of judgment. And judgment here is developed extensively. Matthew chapter 25 is, in a sense, the judgment chapter. And so as we view judgment in this extensive discussion, we recognize that there is no Bible ambiguity on the weight of the topic, on its existence, or on the doctrines that are developed there. And so when we read here, and when we view eschatological issues such as the return of Jesus, those things that he has prepared for his children, the destruction of earth, or a host of other similar topics, it is here that we can find many of the answers that we're seeking, and moreover, we understand how important the subject of Bible judgment is according to the New Testament. Matthew chapter 25 is part of what we call the Olivet Discourse. Jesus had already made his triumphant but bittersweet entry into Jerusalem. At this point, he has already cleansed the temple. He has, in Matthew chapter 23, delivered some of the most strident condemnations that he will ever speak as he condemns the actions of the Pharisees. He also has lamented over the lost city of Jerusalem, saying in Matthew chapter 23 and verse 37, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that stonest the prophets, or killest the prophets, and stonest them that would come unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children beneath my wings as a hen gathereth her chickens, and you would not. And so after he says those things, and after he says something else that we'll talk about in just a moment, he then will retreat to the Mount of Olives. Now, the reason that he would be there is because in the days that he stayed in Jerusalem before his death, and this is evidently the Tuesday before his death, Jesus has been on a daily commute. His days have been spent in the temple, teaching, preaching, but his nights have been spent in Bethany, about 2 miles away and directly beyond the Mount of Olives. And so each day he has undergone what really is a very strenuous journey, a walk back and forth from that place, staying at the home of Simon the leper, according to some other passages, such as Matthew chapter 21 tells us he was staying in Bethany, and I believe about verse 16. But each day he's been going back and forth. And the Mount of Olives is the place from which one can gain the most beautiful, obviously the most panoramic view of the city of Jerusalem. And that's when you see the pictures, modern day pictures of Jerusalem, that's where they're taken from, is from the Mount of Olives. Now, Jesus has just toured the temple complex. And in Matthew chapter 24, in verse 2, he makes the statement which causes his disciples to later find him and ask him the meaning of it. He said, "Not one of these stones will be left standing one upon the other," in Matthew chapter 24, in verse 2. He then retreats to the Mount of Olives. I'm certain that because of the view of that city, that there's no coincidence concerning the place where he chose to pause. Certainly it was on his way back home, or back to the place he was lodging. But I'm certain that with a heavy heart, he continued to reflect upon the fate of that doomed city, upon the lost lives and the souls. Because you see, Jesus knew something. He knew that they were going to die. He knew it was going to be destroyed. And I'm certain that that evening, though Jerusalem had no recollection of it, they had no awareness of it, and perhaps even if they had, they would not have cared. But I'm certain on that evening, the eyes of our Lord were pensively and privately mourning as he looked upon it. And so his disciples ask him, "What do these things mean?" And the answers are found in Matthew chapter 24. And they asked him, of course, the famous three questions about the signs of these things, that is, the destruction, the end of the age, and of your coming. And Jesus combines his answers by telling his disciples that his coming would be in two phases. It would be a metaphor that would be fulfilled by his coming through the armies of Rome in destruction as they destroyed the city of Jerusalem. And then he spoke of a literal coming in which he himself would return in the latter part of Matthew chapter 24. While the major difference between the two would be that the first, his coming in judgment against Jerusalem, would be accompanied by certain but subtle signs, whereas the other would have no signs. Matthew chapter 24 and 36, "Of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels in heaven, but my Father only." And I presume, I've concluded that that also includes Hal Lindsey and some other folks who tell us they do know today. And so Jesus, in the latter part of Matthew chapter 24, then discusses his coming. In Matthew chapter 24, verses 45 through 57, provides a marvelous springboard for our discussion this morning of Matthew chapter 25. Because here, the watchword is watch. And very simply, the theme is watch. You know not the day or hour, so watch. The thief gives no warning, so watch. And so on and so forth. And so, this provides us then with the place from which to view Matthew chapter 25, in which we find two parables, and then a third part of the chapter has a major allegory, so I've chosen to include it in our study, though strictly speaking, I don't think that we can call it a parable. But in each of these, we're talking about a certain day. Obviously, it's the day of judgment. And each of these, there is a theme, and each of these, there is a connection between the themes. In the first, we call the parable of the 10 virgins. The theme is preparation for a day of finality. In the second, which we generally call the parable of the talents, the theme is preparation for a day of reckoning or accounting. And in the third, which simply is a look at the separation at the day of judgment, in which Jesus will divide the nations, or divide all in the nations, I should say, as one would divide the sheep from the goats. The theme, is separation and preparation for the day of separation. Now, let's look first at the parable of the 10 virgins. And I'll try to be as brief as possible. It's tough to cover three such sections in the time that we have, but I'll do the best that I can. The parable of the 10 virgins, found in Matthew chapter 25, verses 1 through 13, has some elements that are a little unfamiliar to our Western mind. Such things as the emphasis on the bridegroom, the separation of the men and women at the wedding feast, and the midnight wedding. All those things are a little unusual to us. Last spring, I had the opportunity to see a couple of Middle Eastern weddings. Not the whole thing, but at least parts, as we toured Israel and Egypt. On the one, which took place in the Nile Hilton, and it took place at midnight. And it took up the entire lobby and the mezzanine of the hotel at a cost that was estimated to me of some $10,000 for the evening. And that was, incidentally, in a comparable place in the United States, we can inflate that by perhaps a factor of three. So I would presume that these people were fairly wealthy. But the entire lobby was full. And it was taking place late at night, and it would continue all night. And there were sounds of the Arabian trumpets being played, and then the strangest thing, somebody started playing bagpipes. I never did get a good explanation of what the connection was there, why that they had bagpipes at an Egyptian wedding. But they did. And to tell you the truth, the way they were throwing money around, I sort of wished I had my fiddle. I thought I might be able to clean up on these people. They could afford that sort of thing. But that wasn't available. But here they were, and here the bridegroom was the celebrated party. I never did see the bride, but I saw the bridegroom. He was being passed by arms up the stairs. And they had all the kinds of customs I wasn't accustomed to. On the other wedding, we were simply driving by near the village of Sychar. And here they were. We came around the corner, and I think we all were just a little bit concerned as we rounded the corner and we saw a group of men firing rifles in the air. And all sorts of things come to mind. But it was a wedding. And they were surrounding the groom, who was seated upon a horse, and they were firing rifles in the air in celebration. And of course, I was thinking they just might decide to shoot something else in celebration. And here's a nice big bus going by, but that didn't happen. But it was all part of the same Middle Eastern custom, and that is that the bridegroom is the celebrated party. Now, as we continue, however, to study in this particular parable, the next thing that I notice is the vitality of wisdom and foolishness. What was the difference between the wise virgins and the wise virgins and the foolish ones? What was the difference? Was their wisdom, whether they had it or not? You know, we have a tendency in speaking of error to at times excuse the error of one who is neither spiteful nor venomous, but only foolish. Now, the Bible obviously discourages spite and venom, but it does not provide a pass for those who are foolish. There is an entire book of the Bible, which evidently was written so that men might learn wisdom. And it's an absolute essential. Men are going to be lost because of foolishness. And we can't just excuse foolishness. 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 13 reads, "Evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived." The difference was in whether they were wise or not. And it's important. But you know, we need to talk about the notion of perseverance. Here are the virgins, gathered, waiting for the coming of the bridegroom. And the Bible tells us, as they waited, the bridegroom delayed. And so the issue seems to be perseverance. Now, every one of us have heard stories or maybe told stories about someone, and we said he would have done well to have been drowned in the baptistry because that was the last day that he ever was faithful. But you know, it really cuts deeper than that. Because it's not just the passing of time that condemns such a one. Yes, certainly, the burden of time is something that people don't seem to be able to bear. And for instance, the parable of the sower, it's the passing of the time that condemns some of these folks. They were faithful for a time. But here's the problem. It is not the passing of time, strictly speaking, that does it, but the lack of commitment from day one and the lack of preparation for eternal commitment. That's the problem. Now, the lamps, that's what the King James calls it. The lamps were actually, we'd call them torches, and they required constant attention. And maybe that's part of it too. Because it wasn't just a matter of lighting a lamp and sitting down and watching it burn. It required constant work to keep it going. We have to ask ourselves, not just have we provided enough, do we think, but have we provided everything? Because that's what it takes. Wherefore, seeing we're compassed about by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race which is set before us. Patience or perseverance. When I was a kid, I had to work in the garden. I didn't like working in the garden. Dad made me work in the garden. That's why I worked in the garden. If it were up to me, I would not have worked in the garden. This was a constant sore spot with us. I felt like he should respect my wishes. He didn't. And he didn't seem to know any of the modern techniques. I thought they were pretty good of parenting. He didn't know those. So after we would have a discussion about it, I ended up working in the garden every time. One of the jobs that I didn't like very much was weeding. And so we used to have a policy that you would have a certain number of rows. And that's what you would weed. When you got done weeding a certain number of rows, then you could be done, do whatever you wanted to do. So after a while, I decided the thing would go a lot quicker if I would just skip a lot of weeds. And it did. So then Dad set up a new policy. It was a time-based policy. And it worked like this. It doesn't matter how many rows you think you got, you're going to weed till a certain time. And then you'll be done. I did this in order to encourage me to do a better job, because I was, as boys do, hurrying through it and half doing it. You know, in a sense, this is what we're talking about today. We're not talking about a goal-oriented salvation. We're not talking about a fast fix. We lose our focus because we ask ourselves, haven't I done enough? Isn't this enough? It's not enough. And there is no fast fix. What we must have is a tough-minded commitment to be faithful for as long as it takes. To do what's right because it's right. Not because there are any immediate goals that we must meet, but to do what's right, whether there are any rewards in sight or not. As we continue, we notice that the bridegroom then appears at midnight. This is not to suggest any sort of a preference for a nighttime return or the advent of Christ. But the element of surprise, it would seem, is important here. And you know, even those who were prepared didn't expect him at midnight. They were just as surprised as the unprepared virgins were, weren't they? But that's the very essence of this parable. Adam Clark relates the words of one Rabbi Eliezer who said, "Turn to the Lord one day before your death." His disciples said, "How can a man know the day of his death?" Eliezer replied, Therefore, turn to him today. Perhaps you may die tomorrow. Thus, every day will be spent in turning to God." At the close of the parable, we find that there is an image that we need to remember, and we'll return to this image in the next parable. The image is of being shut out. There is a time for preparation. And isn't it interesting how people have approached the exchange between the two sets, the wise and the foolish? Because the foolish say, "Let us borrow some of yours." And the wise then reply, "We can't loan you any." Now, the concept that's being explored here is not one of fairness. Somebody might say, "Well, it seems to me it's kind of hard-hearted of those wise virgins to refuse to provide any for somebody else. Didn't they have any compassion on their less fortunate counterparts?" Well, there are two answers to this. Number one, it is stretching a parable to make it answer every question. It's just not part of the parable. But in the application, see, this isn't a parable about compassion. This is a parable about preparation. In the application, in the real world, nobody can prepare for anybody else. And it's not a matter of choice. It's not a matter of refusal. We just can't do it. Maybe it's a sign of our times that that question would even occur to me, the egalitarian concept of fairness. The point isn't fairness, the point is responsibility. We must all stand before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things that he hath done in his body according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad. 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 10. And with that, the door is shut. And it may be in the day of judgment that there are those, not because of immorality, not because of a lack of desire to do that which is right, but simply because of being foolish and not preparing, are not going to be saved. And it reminds us that there was a time to prepare. Everybody had the same opportunity to prepare, and everybody made a choice. And the second parable that we need to consider begins at verse 14. We generally call it the parable of the talents. And the first thing that we notice is the phrase, "a far country." The Lord has traveled into a far country. And so someone asks, is this an indication of the lapse of time between his leaving the earth and his returning to it? Well, obviously, there has been a lack of time that has taken place. But that's not really the point. The point isn't the time that elapsed, but the distance. Jesus himself has departed into a country farther than we can imagine. Moreover, it reminds us that our Lord is not interested in micromanagement of our affairs. He has given us some things that he desires us to use. And then, having left us instructions and opportunities, it's up to us. And we sometimes refer to the application of the talents. We sometimes refer to these as opportunities. Perhaps that's not strong enough language. These are responsibilities, not just opportunities. When the Lord gives us something, He expects us to use it. And so He did, and He delivered, of course, to the three servants, the five, the two, and the one, various responsibilities depending upon His abilities. And then He begins to reward. And there is an element of risk involved. There is a part of me, and perhaps of you as well, there's a part of me that sympathizes with the reaction of the man with one talent. Not with his actions, but with his fear. Because, you see, there was an element of risk. But the kind of fear that we're talking about is the very kind of fear that is condemned. Revelation chapter 21 and verse 8. The fearful and unbelieving, whoremongers, sorcerers, so on and so forth, down through liars, they'll have their place in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone. This is the second death. This kind of fear is the very opposite of trust and faith. In fact, and we're a little ahead of ourselves, but later, the Lord, in His answer to the man who refused to put it to use, His answer to him said, if you were afraid, that fear should have motivated you to do what was right. You should have been afraid to not do it. That's an entirely different kind of fear. But there's an element of risk. Now, the day that the Lord returns seems to have been quite an event as He calls the servants together. And remember, the theme here is preparation in view of a day of accounting or reckoning. And He calls them to give an accounting of the things that they had done with the responsibilities that He had given them. And of course, we remember that the first two did what they should have done. And the third, the man who was given one talent, did not. He was afraid, hid it, brought it back untouched. Now, we ask ourselves, what about extenuating circumstances? Why is it that the Lord did not inquire as to what might have kept Him from doing what He should have done? We're big on extenuating circumstances. And not one word was said in the judgment of the Lord against this man or in favor of the others. But did you know that there are extenuating circumstances? And the Lord knew what they were, and He gave the talents accordingly. The extenuation was in the giving of the talents. We must trust the Lord to not require more of us than we can give. And He's faithful in that regard. That is yet another lesson of the parable of the talents. That's why He gave one five, another two, and another one. He knew the extenuating circumstances. And He knew what each one could give. It is required in stewards that a man be found faithful. 1 Corinthians 4, verse 2. The one who is guilty of much shall be beaten with many stripes. Luke 12, verse 42. 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 2. We are required of, quote, that a man hath, and not that a man hath not. And so God never requires of us more than we have to give. And so in this event, He calls them. And He requires of them. And then we remember the difference between the judgment that the Lord pronounced upon the two, the first two. And here's yet another lesson. Because there are times when we talk about such issues that we will value great service above humble service. And the Lord doesn't think that way. It is interesting that his words to the man who was given five and the man who was given two are identical. There is precisely the same reward and commendation for the two. Why? Each was faithful. Faithfulness is the issue. Yes, the Lord demands results, but faithfulness is the issue. And so then he turns his attention to the unfaithful servant. And it's interesting to me that though this servant had not prepared himself to meet his Lord, he had taken time to prepare excuses. I've wondered if he had spent as much time in trying to provide a return on the investment as he did in preparing excuses, if he, A, would not have been pleasing to the Lord, and B, probably wouldn't have had to work as hard. But his excuses were, "Lord, I was afraid. You're a hard man. You demand results constantly. You're reaping oriented. Is the Lord a hard man?" Evidently, in the sense of this parable, the answer is yes. Because the Lord answered, "You knew I was a hard man." Now, that's not a statement of the compassion or mercy of the Lord. It has nothing to do with that. We're talking about his reaction to one who refuses to do his will. And in that sense, he's a hard man. Faithfulness. Faithfulness is the issue with the servant who failed. We remember now that even those servants who did what they were supposed to, they're still unprofitable servants. It says nothing of the mercy of the Lord. But faithfulness is the issue. Now, in the time that we have remaining, let's turn our attention to the third of the three sections of Matthew chapter 25 while making this observation. As the first parable closes, we have a very dim image of those that are lost. They are shut out. And as the chapter progresses at the close of this parable, we have a much clearer picture in verse 30. "He will be cast into outer darkness. There will be weeping, gnashing of teeth." Somebody asks, how can there be darkness in a place that the Bible describes as a fire? I don't know, and I don't care to find out. But I believe it. Now, in the third section, we're reading about separation in view of preparation, or preparation rather in view of separation. And as this section begins, the veil is lifted. Because we're not speaking in terms of a metaphor as it begins. Now we're not talking about a bridegroom. Now we're not talking about a Lord and his servants. Now the Bible says the Son of Man. And though all three have the same subject matter, each gets progressively clearer and more explicit. So now we're speaking in literal terms. And now he is not departing into a far country. Now he's not being married, but it's the Son of Man on a glorious throne that is not just a symbol of his authority, but now is clearly a symbol of judgment. And that is his purpose. Moreover, the Bible tells us before him will be gathered all nations. Isn't it interesting to compare the words of the Great Commission with this, the chapter of judgment? "Go you therefore and teach all nations. Before him will be gathered all nations." Who is responsible for the gospel and for obedience to it? All nations. That's why we're to teach all nations, because all nations will be gathered before him. And at that point, it is also interesting to reflect upon the fact that, again, results are being demanded. Now the Bible tells us in the book of Revelation again, Revelation chapter 20 and verse 12, I saw the dead small and great stand before God, and the books were open, and another book was opened, which was the book of life, and the dead were judged out of the things written in those books. And on that occasion, and on this, have you noticed that obedience is the theme? This flies in the face of the doctrine of the Calvinist and of pseudo-Calvinists who are in the church, who tell us that judgment has nothing to do with, quote, the things that we do. In this, the last section of the great theme chapter of judgment in the Bible, the only thing that's mentioned is obedience. Now, that doesn't say that there are not some other issues. That does not say that empty obedience, devoid of faith, is worthwhile to God. It does not say that. But notice what the criteria is. This is that section where Jesus says, if you were benevolent, you will be accepted with me. If you were not, you will not be. Now, we have no way to know this for sure, but it seems reasonable based upon his recent discussions with the Pharisees that their attitude, their action, their hard-heartedness is probably what he had in mind. But it didn't just speak to them, it spoke to everybody. If you refuse to do what's right, you will be lost, and it's that simple. Separation takes place because of a life of separation. In fact, what Jesus does in this last section, is simply honors what people have chosen to do in their lives. They chose to be goats. Jesus did not create a separation. He simply looked and he said, here are the goats. I see them. I know what a goat is. Here are the sheep. I know what a sheep is. I want to close this lesson this morning by pointing out very briefly the difference between everlasting punishment and eternal life in the last verse of Matthew chapter 25. They are precisely the same. Whatever everlasting is eternal. Whatever eternal is everlasting. Do you believe in everlasting life? If you believe the Bible, we're going to have to believe in eternal punishment as well.